to our Owen podcast, a podcast for the Ontario Animal Health Network. I'm Dr. Cynthia Miltenberg, co-lead of the Owen Bovine Network.
Joining me today is Dr. Katie Clow and master's student Valentina Gonzalez-Rodriguez. Katie is an assistant professor in One Health in the Department of Population Medicine at the Ontario Veterinary College. Her research focuses on the ecology and epidemiology of vector-borne and zoonotic diseases. And we also have Valentina. Valentina is a master's student in the Department of Population Medicine at the University of Guelph, where she previously earned her Bachelor of Science with honors in Biological Sciences. She completed an undergraduate thesis on vector-borne diseases, identifying the diversity of Culicoides vectors on livestock farms in Ontario. Thank you for joining me today, Katie and Valentina.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
So we're going to actually go through this project that I mentioned Valentina had done as her undergraduate thesis and ask a few questions about that. So for those not familiar, can you describe what Culicoides species are? Where do they live and what kind of environment do they live in?
Yeah, so Culicoides is a genus of biting midges, commonly known as noceums. These insects are known vectors of over 40 viruses globally, vectors meaning that they can transmit diseases to both animals and humans. And Culicoides are the primary vectors of blue tongue virus and epizootic hemorrhagic disease virus, and these severely affect ruminants. They are very small in size, about 1 to 3 millimeters in size, and this means that they're about smaller than fruit flies, and usually gray or brown in color. They are hematophagous, which means that they feed on the blood of animals and humans as a part of their life cycle, and they're found worldwide, so across the United States, and most commonly found in the southern states or southern provinces of Canada. And Culicoides are particularly suited to environmental areas with moist or muddy ground, as these are considered the optimal breeding sites. This includes semi-aquatic habitats such as ponds or marshes and standing water, as well as manure piles.
That's great. Can you tell us a little bit more about the significance of the Culicoides to livestock? So you mentioned that they can transmit a couple of different diseases. Can you tell us a little bit more about just that area and how livestock are affected by these vectors?
Yeah, so I can jump in there. So when we think about Culicoides, there's two reasons why we think that they're significant. One is they're biting insects, so they're pests, which, especially when burdens get high, can lead to a lot of skin irritation. And horses actually can develop a hypersensitivity reaction to them, which is never very pleasant. And then the other big category is thinking about them as vectors, so being able to transmit different pathogens. And as Valentina had mentioned, the big ones that we think about in Canada revolve around ruminants, so blue tongue virus and epizootic hemorrhagic disease virus, big names. Blue tongue virus mostly affects sheep and to a lesser extent cattle, and can also affect some wild ruminants. And then EHDV, or epizootic hemorrhagic disease virus, mostly affects the cervid population. So we particularly think wild white-tailed deer. And it can be really virulent in white-tailed deer populations. So we see high morbidity and mortality, especially if the populations are naive, so they've never been exposed to it previously.
So that's a great introduction to this vector. Can you tell us, introduce us to the project that you completed looking at Culicoides? So what were the goals of your project?
So the Owen project started really organically, which is really nice because it came out of several Owen species networks. So the small ruminant network, the bovine network, and the equine network all had separately identified Culicoides as a potential priority area that there wasn't a lot of research in, and that more research could be done specifically in Ontario. And so I was approached by Owen and those network leads to think about what a project could look like doing some baseline surveillance in Ontario. And so then we collaboratively developed this project that would involve sampling, particularly in areas where we didn't have any data. There had been a few small projects that had been done throughout Ontario, but there were certainly gaps in our knowledge, and then there wasn't ongoing surveillance. And so we really set out with this goal to describe where and when we were seeing different Culicoides species, and if any of these were vector species, characterizing where and when we were finding them.
So let's talk about what you did. So you were out there collecting Culicoides species in Ontario. How do you catch little bugs who are smaller than a fruit fly, Valentina?
So we started off working with producers from 9 different farm sites across Ontario, starting from about the London region and eastwards to just south of Ottawa. And these farms included different commodity groups. So we had 3 cattle farms, 2 equine farms, and 4 ovine farms. And we really wanted that diversity in commodity groups because we have seen that there could be potential host preferences with different species of Culicoides, which is quite interesting. And so then we started out by using CDC light traps, and these are effective sampling devices for vector surveillance. They are very small and lightweight, making them easy to carry and transport to sampling areas. And the way in which they work is by using black light to attract insects. So Culicoides, they exhibit what's called positive phototaxis. And this means that they are successfully lured by a light source, in this case, specifically black light wavelengths. And the fan within the trap runs automatically, and this is what sucks them into a collection container. So we set up 2 traps on each site, and then we placed one near livestock and one near a potential habitat. So like I mentioned earlier, that would include anywhere with moist mud or manure piles. And then those traps were set at about 2 meters above ground. And this is, we know, is the approximate height at which Culicoides fly. The traps collected samples for a period of 7 weeks from June to September 2022. And the producers sent us these samples each week to be stored in our lab.
So once you had these samples, then what was the next steps? Like, how did you go about identifying what you had in the samples? Did you just have Culicoides? Were there other insects in there as well?
Yeah, so we collected tons of different insects in each sample. We had about 106 samples total. And what we started out with was morphological identification for these samples, and this would include using an identification key developed by experts here at the University of Guelph in the Hanner Lab. This identification key is still in preparation and provided us with the most up-to-date information on Culicoides species found in Ontario. Insect identification and taxonomy really is a really dynamic science, which can make insect identification quite challenging. When identifying species, essentially I would take a sample, a collection container, and place a subset of that sample in a petri dish, view it under a stereoscope, and use tweezers to sort all of the different insects and pinpoint the Culicoides and identify them to the species or subgenus level. And for those who don't know, a subgenus level is is essentially just a group of different species. And generally with morphological identification, you aren't always able to identify to the species level. So some of those were left to just the subgenus level. And I would say with morphological identification, one of the best aspects of this approach is that we were able to quantify the abundance of each species in every sample, something that's not quite possible with molecular techniques. And this approach, however, was quite labor-intensive and time-consuming. And it tends to have variable reliability. So we are currently implementing a validation protocol to minimize that issue. The other second identification technique that we used, or approach, let's say, is molecular identification. So that was just where we had sent about 55 samples that had too large of an abundance for morphological identification. And we had sent those to the Agriculture and Food Laboratory here at the University of Guelph. And they just processed the environmental DNA in which that comes from the solution in which the insects are stored. So that was a really great approach in terms of the fact that it has a shorter processing time. And we were able to differentiate those species that are morphologically very similar due to interspecies variation. So that was great. And we thought that using a combination of both that morphological and molecular identification techniques would be best for this project.
So let's talk about what you found then when you actually looked at the Culicoides species. What were the species that were collected, and, you know, what's the significance of finding those particular species?
Yeah, so after working with those producers in Ontario, we first had our results separated between the morphological and molecular results. So I guess I'll start off with the molecular analysis results. And we found Culicoides bigotatus to be the most commonly found species by far. And this was great because this was consistent with the current literature for the Culicoides bigotatus abundance in Ontario. As far as we know, Culicoides bigotatus is not considered a potential vector species here in Canada, so it wouldn't pose a public health risk. Our morphological results showed that the subgenus Avaricia group of species was found at all 9 sites that we sampled. And this group is quite interesting because it contains both vector species and non-vector species. The vector species that we were most interested within this group were 3 potential vectors for blue tongue virus, and these were Culicoides chiopteris, Culicoides obsoletus, and Culicoides sanguisuga. So these 3 species are potential vectors. And then another really interesting finding that we had was that there was a higher abundance of Culicoides species near potential habitat areas on these farm sites. So those areas with standing water or manure compared to areas closer to livestock.
So just so I understand there, what you're saying is that you found a greater abundance on those kind of more natural habitats and fewer near where the actual livestock, whether that's cattle or sheep or horses, where they were occupying the pasture location at that time.
Yes, that is what we found. And that's why we had 2 separate traps placed on each site so that we could see if there was any potential difference between those areas, and it was great that we did find a difference there.
Were there any other geographical differences throughout the province? I'm not sure if you know that off the top of your head, but you know, I know you had some sites in eastern Ontario, some sites in central Ontario, and some in southwestern Ontario. Were there any variability, or was it fairly consistent?
I would say it was fairly consistent. So like I mentioned earlier, subgenus Afrasia, that group with potential vectors, was found at all of these sites. We did find some, so we did try to map out the potential vectors that were identified, and those did not seem to have very much of a geographical difference. Off the top of my head, Colliquides stellifer, which is a significant potential vector for both blue tongue virus and epizootic hemorrhagic disease virus, it was found all across regions, so all the way from the London area to the just southern of Ottawa area.
So you mentioned, I'm just going to revisit this idea because, you know, veterinarians who are listening to this podcast were thinking, you know, they're thinking on the ground, is there a risk of some of these diseases being transmitted? So you mentioned, you know, blue tongue and epizootic hemorrhagic disease. We know also on the equine side, although we don't, you know, have African horse sickness or equine encephalosis virus, you know, would we have the vector that could transmit those if they were suddenly introduced? So did we find those Culicoides species then?
Yeah, so I can jump in there. So when we're thinking about those key diseases or key viruses, so Culicoides sonarensis is the big one when we're thinking about blue tongue virus and epizootic hemorrhagic disease virus. And Culicoides sonarensis was found on two premises in two very different areas of the province. And so it certainly was not the most abundant or most widespread, but the findings indicate that it is here. We can't determine from 1 year of sampling if that population is established or that there's longer term risk, especially because these little biting insects are so small, they generally can be blown in the wind hundreds of kilometers. And so to really understand the significance of that finding, we would need to monitor longer term, but they are there. And if they, regardless of whether they're here permanently or being introduced, there's still that low level of risk because we know that they can transmit those viruses. As Valentina had mentioned, Culicoides stellifer is one of these sort of question mark vectors. And so for something to be considered a competent vector, it needs to be matched with field data and laboratory-based data. And for some vectors, there's just not all of the research available to really help us do that because these studies are expensive. But there is some field data to support that Culicoides stellifer could have a role in transmission of these two viruses. And like Valentina said, that was widespread across premises. So if we think about, you know, some Culicoides sonarensis potentially being blown up and introducing a virus, and then there being higher populations of native Culicoides that can transmit that, that would be important for us to understand a little bit more. And then if we think about the equine viruses, so African horse sickness and equine encephalosis virus, like you said, both of which we don't have here and are considered exotic diseases, and African horse sickness being reportable. So Culicoides obsoletus is a known vector, and we found that on all premises. So essentially, if a virus was introduced in a host, we do have the vector capable of transmitting it. Fortunately, there are really strict import requirements on countries where those viruses do exist. And so that's just really, I guess, supporting rationale that those requirements make a lot of sense because, you know, without the virus, we don't care much about the vector being here. But if the virus was here, we'd have a whole new risk because we do have thriving populations of that vector. So all things to just take into consideration, I guess.
That's really helpful, yeah. And what about, you mentioned there was a couple different livestock species on the sites that you used. We had cattle, we had sheep, we had horses. Were there differences in the different, I think most of the premises had kind of one type of livestock. Mm-hmm. So were there differences between livestock that you saw that like one species was either more bothered by or had a different type of Culicoides species near them?
So Valentina and I were discussing how this is a great question that we aren't quite ready to answer yet. There is literature that has suggested that there are host preferences based on species type. And it's something that we want to explore further in our data. Because this was a pilot study, and we only have, you know, a small number of different types of premises, we're pretty limited in sort of the more advanced statistical analyses that we can do, but certainly we can look at the data descriptively. We want to look at it more in depth over space and time to also understand if there's potential seasonal fluctuations. And so those are all things that are, I guess, on our to-do list. The sample processing, because there were so many insects, has taken a good portion of time. And so we have a lot of strong basic data to go off of now.
Okay, so stay tuned.
Exactly.
Let's just talk about the surveillance you did generally and, you know, the benefits to our livestock industries to have vector surveillance, such as what you did with the Culicoides traps.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, to me, surveillance is like the foundational data of anything else we're going to do. It's going to give us, it's going to, like, we need surveillance data to be able to do any kind of risk assessment, even to answer, is it here, is it not, how frequent it is, and then build more epidemiological analysis and studies off of that to understand risk factors. And so the thing about surveillance is that surveillance is most valuable if it's done systematically and long-term, which is always a challenge because the longer you do things and the wider scale you do things, it becomes more and more expensive, which is always sort of an argument for and against surveillance, I guess. This study gives us a really good baseline off which we can base things. There has not been a lot of Culicoides work in the province, and so most of it is based off of sampling here or there, or records of cases and a little bit of sampling around the cases to understand if the vector is there. And now we have a year long, essentially, of ongoing monitoring that forms this baseline data set and then is going to help us as we design future studies and ongoing monitoring to compare this to. So it has inherent value in risk assessment in EPI, but we still need to build off of it. And I'm a researcher, so I always want more data. So I'm probably always going to say that, but
that's a fair that you acknowledge your bias, perhaps.
Yes.
Katie, all of your research centers, or not all of it, but much of your research centers in vector-borne disease. So maybe as we wrap up here, you can kind of speak from a more general perspective. Vector-borne disease, certainly I know in my work, I see it getting more attention due to the potential impacts of a changing climate. Can you speak to some of the risks for introduction or expansion geographically mm-hmm. for vector diseases, and particularly from the impacts that it might have on livestock?
Mm-hmm. So the most of the arthropod species that we're dealing with that are vectors, so we can think of ticks, mosquitoes, biting midges, are very reliant on external conditions to support their survival. So temperature and humidity are key considerations whenever we're thinking about vector survival, reproduction, and activity, all of which then translate into risk of exposure and potential pathogen exposure and then disease development. And so we don't have a ton of research in the Culicoides space, particularly in Canada, but I think we can expand some of that, some other research that has existed, thinking about, so we have warmer temperatures overall and longer summers, which support increased vector survival and activity, which then translates into longer periods of biting and exposure for our livestock species. With the Culicoides in particular, as I said, they can be blown hundreds of kilometers in through wind. And as we have more and more extreme weather events as forecasted with climate change, this becomes a consideration as well. So maybe the vector species isn't here right now, but with more and more of these extreme weather events, incursions can happen more frequently. For any sort of climate change research, there is value in looking at ecological relationships and then doing forecasting to understand where that potential might exist. That helps direct future surveillance. And so that's something that should be a priority moving forward with biting midges, is to really understand more about that climate change impact and where that might expand into the future.
Thanks for that. It's an exciting and important area of ongoing work. And I appreciate you joining us both today to tell us about this project and some of these initial findings that, you know, veterinarians in Ontario should be aware of. And we hope to keep up with you and ongoing work and hear how things continue to evolve. So I want to thank all our listeners for joining us for this OWEN podcast. For more information about the OWEN Species Networks or to access any of our producer or quarterly veterinary reports and other resources, please check out our website at owen.ca.